Hi, Eric. What are we going to talk about today?
Well, do you want to talk about your new house?
No, not really. I do have of the stuff. I was looking through the – and sorry I haven't been commenting, but
– You're fine.
Busy moving.
That's fine.
Of all the things that you wrote about, the one topic we should probably address is the NC2A committee.
Yeah.
Selection committee. Because we've – I mean, we've talked about that forever.
Yeah.
But never on the podcast. So.
Yeah. So did you read the story with Barnhart?
I didn't get up. I started to read it this morning and then Marcus got up. So I never got back to finish it.
So I – okay. So the deal is that we've got this blog called HeathPost.com. And in a post – in an O Kentucky post. It's titled O Kentucky. But anyway, I linked to a story about the University of Kentucky athletic director who I think – I can't remember now the details, but I think he's cycling off the NCAA selection committee.
No,
he just did
his first year.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So it was his observations after his first year. And he basically – the only thing that I kind of found new at all was he was just talking about like sort of the – how you kind of hear everybody's – he has more appreciation for how everyone's kind of got a story and that different coaches weigh different things. And so, for example, a defensive-minded coach tends to think defensive teams are better and deserve, you know, higher respect in the bracket than – higher placement in the bracket than teams that are offensive. And then you get coaches that are the opposite way. And you know, which I thought was a pretty, no kidding, kind of comment. That makes sense. But what it occurred to me is I think the problem is, to me, the problem with this whole process is that that committee is discussing teams as opposed to coming up with some kind of process. They should really be, I think that their job should be coming up with the equation for seating the committee as opposed to discussing the merits of one team versus another. Because at that point, it just becomes who's the best arguer.
Agreed.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with that. Well, and I think too, it's funny. I read more of the article than I remember. I was just looking it up. But it's funny too, because at one point he talks about, oh, they watched so many games and he was impressed by how much time they spend, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, not to sound awful, but yeah, but they're probably watching the SEC, the ACC, the Big Ten, the Pac-12, barely. And, you know, I'm just not sure that that's really what's necessary. Like, I'm kind of like you on this one. I don't know that you have to sit and watch every team, every game. But there's certainly teams that's not being watched who should probably be in the tournament.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a team that wins 27 games in the regular season and then they lose their conference tournament and they don't make it in, I'm sorry, that's a joke, you know.
Well, I would have an argument with the basic okay, so what's the job – What's the objective here? And it seemed like to me, and I think this has actually been talked about very forthrightly, and maybe it just finally hit me in the head like a hammer. They are trying to identify that committee. Their mission seems to be to identify the 64 or whatever, however many slots there are now.
68,
whatever. The X number best teams in the country. And right. I actually have a problem with that.
I do too.
I would have a problem. That I don't. We're not doing basketball lab. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not that interested in that. I want the 68 most qualified. You know, what did you do during the season to get to the tournament? And so maybe there's just a break. Maybe I want something that they're not going to do, you know. But that's where I, like, spend so much of my anger. I mean, I don't really care if, you know, if Kentucky – I don't care if Kentucky has the best collection of basketball players and has the most potential to win the tournament. If they end up going 14-16 during the regular season, I don't want them in the NCAA tournament unless they win their conference tournament. Right. And that's the rules of the conference. And so, I mean, it just, to me, it's just, well, that's tough. You should have won more, you know?
No, I'm with you on that. And I think this is one of my frustrations with the move to 68 teams. Was all it's really been is a way to get more of the big conference teams in.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they say, well, we'll make this 11 seed. They'll have to play into the 11 seed. And so we're picking the teams that are on the bubble that would – but it's always, always, always big conference teams. And it always comes at the price of, you know, a smaller conference team who had a great record during the regular season who failed to win their tournament. I mean –
yeah.
I'm with you on that. That to me is the one thing, and I would like, that's the one thing I would like to hear them actually talk about publicly during these, like, I'm like you, they should make the meetings public. And that would be the one question I would want to, my guess is they never even bring up the school. It never even comes up in the conversation.
That could be.
I can't believe, my guess is nobody sits there and says, well, what about this team that's 27-10 or whatever? I don't even think it happens. I think they just ignore the small conferences completely.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Those teams specifically, you think that they're not really given much credence. They like
I don't even think they're mentioned. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Like once they kind of identify, okay, this conference is only going to get one participant,
right.
Then that part of their job is done.
Right.
I'll bet you're right. I hadn't thought about that, but I'll bet you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean if Murray State wins 30 games, and they lose the OVC tournament, there's no way they're getting in.
Yeah, I mean, there could be the outlier where you would have a team that, you know, had just specifically scheduled to get themselves in the tournament and you know, just kind of gone overboard and got them. Like, I think Gonzaga, you know, before Gonzaga became a power, a national power,
there was
a few seasons there where they kind of scheduled themselves into the conversation and got like up to number four in the country at one point, you know, some stuff like that. And so there are probably some anomalies, but I'll bet you're right. Oh, it's a good observation. Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, if you can crack the top 20, I think that's a different
then
thing.
Start to merit some consideration. Right. I hear you. Yeah. Well, I just, so my point is that, so first of all, it's probably just a breakdown that they are really tasked with doing something that I wouldn't even task them with. I mean, that's, you know, first of all, and until you get kind of agreement on that, you can't do anything else. But then to get the tournament that I want of that, like, 68 most qualified teams, then what I want the committee to do is quit talking about any teams, and even before the season starts, I want them to come up with what's their metric, and then basically I want it to be totally transparent, and you can see with each result where teams are moving up and down, you know, whether or not they're qualifying for the tournament. I think that would be fascinating.
The only problem with a set metric, of course, is that you run into the problem that teams will try to play the system. Yeah, they'll try to game it, but
so that
you know.
But, you know, that, where is that not true anywhere in society?
Right. Oh, I know.
And then it's incumbent. That's why you do have a committee. It's not set in stone. And so, you know, you review the tournament after the season and you say, did we really get the 68 in? And how did, you know, and so let's tweak the metric again,
right.
You know. And but I just think it's so crazy. You know, this is not I don't know. I don't even know if I agree with myself here, but I can't help but think. I mean, these are public universities in most cases.
Right.
We're talking public university teams, and it's just astounding amount of money that gets, you know, that's at stake.
It's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And
well, and this is why I think it becomes such a big issue, because if you are a Murray State,
yes.
And you have a 30-win season and then you fail to make the tournament, you have cost not only your team, your school, but you've cost your conference.
Oh, yeah.
A ton of money if two schools had gotten in. I mean, that's the trick, right? It's like you want two schools to get in to help your conference. Yeah. Well, and I think the other issue here obviously would be, you know, you and I have talked about this before, but how do you keep people then from saying, well, we'll just take the conference tournament off.
Yeah.
So we can get another team in from our conference.
Right.
So you would have to try, you'd have to address that issue as well.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, absolutely would. There's, it's not, you know, it's not fail safe.
Right.
Yeah, you got to do some work around it. And so there's a lot of money at stake. And there's a lot of, and, you know, even if there's wasn't a whole bunch of money, you know, there's just a bunch of people that pay attention and people get excited about it and that sort of thing. And it's just crazy that we entrust that whole thing to sort of this like cloak and dagger, almost like picking the officers of a club or something like that. It's just
right.
So,
right.
It's just such a little, you know, backroom deal, that's so cloaked in mystery. And I don't know.
One of the things I wondered about from reading Barnhart was it made me question whether we should have coaches at all as part of the selection committee. Like, if they can't see past their own vision of the game,
yeah,
to pick teams, like to make decisions,
yeah,
then why are they even involved?
Right, right. And I think he's talking about like ex coaches in that case, because I think it is.
No, it is ex coaches, but
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, but then pick people who don't have those kind of prejudices built in.
Yeah,
you know, pick ordinary citizens.
Right. Yeah. Right. So it just kind of, I mean, I don't have a big, you know, Barnhart's just being drafted into I didn't have a big problem with anything he said. I mean, he's kind of just.
Well, I wish when Katzpah's, the question I would have asked him was, so why is it then that Kentucky always ends up playing like Northern Kentucky?
Well, that's just,
you know, and why is it that that doesn't happen to Duke? Like, why didn't Duke play North Carolina Central? Right. Why didn't UNC play UNC Wilmington?
Yeah.
Like, why do they do that to every school except for the North Carolina schools? Like, that's the kind of stuff. I mean, it's Katzpah's interviewing him, for God's sake. Like,
yeah, no,
that's,
I agree.
That's exactly the kind of thing UK fans are thinking about.
Yeah,
so.
Well, I agree with that. I agree with that. Yeah, there's those kinds of things that I'd like to know more about.
I mean, there's obvious decisions being made about matchups. Like,
yeah.
We want this matchup.
Yeah.
It's got to be, right? I mean, there's no way you put Kentucky and UCLA and North Carolina all together in the same,
right.
Except that you want those matchups.
Yeah, right.
So.
Oh, that tournament that they set up this year was just for Kentucky. It was just, I mean, it was like a.
Barnhart didn't have a problem with it, though. So.
What's that? I'm sorry?
Barnhart had complained in years past, but apparently he was okay with this year. So.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I thought he, you know. That's right. It was worse this year than ever in the one year that he was on the committee.
Right.
I don't know. He probably felt like he couldn't. Maybe I do have a big problem with Barnhart, because he probably did just stand down to not make waves in his first year. I mean, truthfully, they probably saw that as a great opportunity to totally hose, you know.
Sure.
Hose, because Barnhart would felt like people would be crying favoritism if he was arguing for his own team. So.
Sorry, I went to some website that popped up and played music in the background, so you didn't hear it, but it's going to show up on the recording. So,
oh,
I hate those websites that do that.
Oh, I know.
I'm okay. Look, ads are fine.
Yeah,
you know, but when you have autoplay videos, that drives me crazy.
Well, my big air conditioner just came on, so I just
nice.
Yeah. Production quality is really high today.
Oh, you know. So what did you think of the U.S. Open? I didn't get to watch any of it. I talked to Go Heath about it at length, so I know his thoughts on it. But and did you hear what Sands said on Kornheiser?
I thought Sands and Michael Kornheiser were both really great about it. And I thought they were both correct they brought up different points, and I imagine they were both true. I watched quite a bit of it. I thought it was a clunker to start, and I think what Sands and Kornheiser both said about the problems with the course and it not being aligned with what the USGA was shooting for and all that kind of stuff, that all stuff was correct. Now, for somebody who's a level of golf fan that I am, which is basically just tuning in for the majors and not at all a skillful player,
right?
It turned into a pretty good tournament on the last day, even for not having like one of the big name stars. I will say this about Brooks Koepka. He's been around. You know, he has been.
Yeah, no, he's not a joke of a player. I mean, he was in the Ryder Cup and.
Yeah, for the last 4 years, he's been in. I mean, I searched his name at the Heath Post for that very reason, and just how frequently he's been in contention of majors. So, I mean, I don't think he is like some crazy winner. You know, I think he might actually win a couple more. He's one of the best players in the country for sure. He was key in that Ryder Cup, and so I thought it was fine. I thought it was a good tournament. I do get the point. So what Steve Sands was saying on the Kornheiser podcast yesterday about the width of the fairways, and I'm sure this is out there somewhere, but I think the thing to do would be to look at is to map all the drives, you know, map everybody off the tee and overlay, you know, these tee shots. How many of, you know, like, what would have been a more suitable width of these fairways, and then see who was, who was more frequently sort of like in an area of the fairway on the edges of the fairway that probably shouldn't have been fairway, you know, right. That should have been, and look at the players who most benefited by having the wider fairways. That would be interesting to see. What Sands was saying is that it sounded like, well, that it's not like that would have produced a Jordan Spieth or Rory McIlroy winner, that was their problem anyway, is that they were still driving all over the place. So to the extent that that's what we wanted, is to set up a tournament that boils down to these individuals who we think are the best players in the world, that probably wouldn't have achieved it. Maybe what Michael Kornheiser then was saying about the greens, the green layout, would have been more effective. But I don't know. Golf. Man, the golf crowd goes deep. I mean, they are really.
Well, Go Heath had an interesting way of thinking about this, which I had honestly never thought about. And maybe he's written about it, I don't know, on the mm-hmm. Heath Post in the past. But yeah. He was saying that if you look at the Masters and the way the Masters is set up, it's sort of set up to reward you for certain things, right? And then punish you for other things. Like, if you're a good driver, you're highly rewarded at the Masters. If you're a great irons player, you're highly rewarded at the Masters because the way the greens are structured, you have to be able to hit the ball into the zone where you have to hit it into, or you're really going to pay for it.
Yeah.
And then lastly, they really reward you for being a great putter. And I think and his idea from that is that's why you always end up with a winner who's, you know, a top-level player and at the Masters or consistently. And I thought that was an interesting way to think about it. You know, so if you're thinking about setting up Aaron Hills and you try to think in those terms, you know, obviously the things that are missing there are – kind of all three, right? I mean, you're rewarded if you're a big driver at Aaron Hills because it's a long course, and so if the longer hitter you are, the better setup you're going to have.
Right.
But, you know, because of the way the greens are set up, you're not punished if you're not a great iron player, right?
Yeah, that's
because you can land 30 feet and the greens are so true. And these guys, even the worst putters on the PGA Tour are the best putters in the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they got a 30-foot putt that's going to be true, perfectly straight all the way, they're going to hit it. They're just going to hit it, you know.
Right.
So, I don't know. I thought that was an interesting way to think about it.
Yeah. So, I guess that in this case, this tournament, as long as you could hit it long off the tee, there was nothing else that was really standing in your way from getting birdies, right? I mean, as long as you could hit it a long way.
Which nowadays, so all these guys hit.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and that's why Brian Harman was scrambling to keep up the whole time. And he was the most impressive individual golfer over the first 3 days, because he was really having to scramble once he got – I mean, he had to hit he had to play exceptional around the green because he doesn't drive it so far. But even if you're driving and you're – as long as you could drive, even if you're erratic, the width of the fairways was allowing you to stay in contention there.
Right.
So, yeah, it was – the only thing it tested was your ability to drive a long, long way. And I get that. I mean, if I was – I would – you know – if I was this like deep dive golf fan, if that was my main sport, that would annoy me too. I'm not really that guy. You know, I'm a guy who does turn into a majors, and it actually did kind of turn into a pretty interesting tournament down the stretch.
Sure.
And Koepka won it. I mean, that was the other thing too. That's kind of the most important thing to me, is that it did not feel like this war of attrition,
right,
who bogeyed the least on the last. I mean, to me, that's always the least satisfying on a Sunday afternoon. Koepka, you know,
I agree with that.
You know, he kind of held her in those first, you know, there was a bunch of guys within two strokes of each other at the top of the leaderboard all weekend long. And then on the back nine, he just went out and ran away with it. And so to me, that's very satisfying. And the fact that he had been around, you know, it wasn't the first time I'd heard of him. It made for a decent tournament for me. But, shoot, I understand the people that are, like, you know, really into it. And golf, truthfully, unlike college basketball that we were just talking about, golf kind of is – I think it's fine if golf sort of, like, manages itself for the people that most love golf, you know. And if it makes itself – I mean, golf by nature, it's an individual sport. It's a country club sport. You know, twist it as much as you need to make it, you know, most appealing, you know, to the relatively small group of people. Then when it comes to something like college basketball, college football, I mean, I'm in favor of a football playoff. When it comes to those sorts of giant popular sports, I want it to be a little bit more, you know, lean more towards the casual fans and that sort of thing. But I think it's fine if golf, you know.
Well, some sports are driven by individuals.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, golf has always been – it's driven by its stars.
Yeah, of course. Know? It's an individual sport. I mean, that's,
Arnold Palmer was Arnold Palmer because he was Arnold Palmer. You know, it's like –
yeah, right.
He is the godfather of golf because of who he was and the
yeah.
and the fans that he had. So I agree with you there. I mean, and that's totally different than team sports. You know, team sports are just different. I mean, I'm kind of with you on that.
Yeah.
They have to be looked at differently, treated differently. That's one of the problems I have with
yeah.
the I wonder about this sometimes with the NBA. You know, the NBA has drifted – to become such a star-based sport rather than a
yeah.
team-based sport, that I wonder sometimes if that helps or hurts long-term. But
yeah.
they're doing well right now, so.
Did they do well? I guess they did. I guess that.
Well, this new contract they've got, TV contract they've got, apparently is apparently ridiculously huge because contracts are –
yeah.
going to go up to some ridiculous amount, you know. I mean, we're getting to the point where they're making baseball money.
Yeah.
They're talking about yeah. Steph Curry having a $200 million contract. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
yeah. So.
Well. There you go. Sports.
Yeah, no food this week. Although I was sad to see that one barbecue place closing in
yeah.
Grand Rivers. Knott's.
Yeah. With you, Grand Rivers. Yeah.
Have you been there?
Nah. There's a candy store that's like just a couple doors away from it. That's a little – it's in a – there's just like one strip. And it's kind of outside of the downtown Grand Rivers where Patty's Settlement is and that
right.
sort of thing. And there's a candy store right along that path that I go into the candy store, but I'm not that big of a barbecue fan, so I've never gone to that barbecue shop. But I'm concerned about the candy store. I wonder, I thought it was owned by the same people in it, but I may be wrong about that. So I'm really kind of interested in that.
What kind of candy when you say candy store? It's like homemade candy?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. Chocolates and stuff? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I'm pretty concerned about it. Like, I think that they do a lot. I think they bring in some taffy. I don't think they make that there. But, I've gotten, you know, like white chocolate coconut haystacks and stuff like that in that place. That's kind of my go-to candy shop candy. And I've gotten those in there. And I talked to the guy for a long time one day. They had tried to sell it a number of times and never could find a suitable buyer. So he was just kind of doing it. And it kind of made me think, ooh, I bet that's the same guy who has the barbecue shop.
Well, I kind of wondered about that, like why it was closing instead of having been sold. And closing in such an odd time of year, too, since it's a seasonal restaurant. It made me wonder if they had been trying to sell it and trying to sell it and finally just said, you know.
I think that goes on a whole bunch. Just forget it. I think that goes on a whole bunch. I think there's a lot of – I think – I just know from my own family and from yours, frankly, that small business people, their kids, in most cases, want nothing to do with the small business. Their parents had because they saw how hard it was.
Yeah.
And nobody dares wants to do that. And then the economics of actually selling a small business are so crazy.
Well, you almost end up losing money on it in the end. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So it's the pretty –
yeah, they'll probably sell off the parts and make money off that instead.
Yeah.
I've driven by there. That's about it for me.
Yeah.
I never stopped either. And I love barbecue, so I usually like to stop at barbecue joints. But I never drove through Lyon County that – I mean, like
– Right.
I never drove through there that much, so
– Yeah, it's – it is Lyon County, I think.
Yeah,
I think
it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Lyon County is the weirdest, anyway. That's the weirdest dang place in the world.
Why do you say that?
Okay, so there's a number of things about Lyon County. For one thing...
I like the fact that you have thoughts on this.
Oh, I do. I totally do. And I mean, there's probably an explanation for each one of these things, but here's some curiosities about Lyon County. I'll give you three. Okay, number one, its courthouse was not burned during the big Confederate guerrilla raid through this area during the Civil War.
Okay.
It's because the guerrilla leader was a Lyon County native. Okay.
Well, there you go.
So he didn't burn down their courthouse. Okay. Number two, they don't have a football team. Lyon County High School would have to be big enough. I'd have to look.
Wait,
at the
really?
Football. Right. Lyon County football does not play football. Or Lyon County High School does not play football. That's weird.
Really?
Yeah. And number three, Lyon County, all throughout Western Kentucky, there are Christian Church Disciples of Christ congregations. There are also Churches of Christ and, independent Christian. Those are the three strains of the Stone Campbell movement, which, you know, eventually have church splits over stuff like, are you going to have music in your sanctuaries and stuff like that? Or are you going to be connected to a denomination. Anyway, all the counties in Western Kentucky tend to have all three of those Stone Campbell movement types of churches, except Lyon County does not have a Christian Church Disciples of Christ congregation.
Huh.
Princeton does. Benton does. You know? But Lyon County doesn't. And I just, there's something about, I mean, and the other thing, I'll give you a fourth one. The other thing, too, and this is totally, just totally subjective, but it seems to me that anytime I meet somebody from Lyon County, they speak more longingly about their home than any other Kentuckians I know. So, like, they are the most Kentucky of the Kentucky, as far as I'm concerned.
That's interesting.
In the same way that, like, people all over the country – you know, like you or, you know, and really more so like Goheath and some other people, you know, in the same way that people have this odd lifelong connection to Kentucky and they speak longingly about it, although they don't necessarily want to live here and that sort of thing. Lyon County is like the most concentrated sense of that. And I don't get why, but there's just something in the water out there. Those people, they're more Lyon County than they are Kentucky, and certainly more than they are United States. So I don't know. Yeah, I do. I Lyon County, I like it. I mean, I love going over there, but it's a really, it's its own place for sure.
You know, I would have never guessed that they didn't have a football team.
Isn't that wild?
Strange to me. Yeah. I mean, I was just looking at Wikipedia. It was saying that, yeah there's over 8,000 people. So, yeah, so there's certainly enough people to have a football team. I don't know how big those schools are. I was trying to think. They're just the one high school, right? Lyon County?
Yes. Public schools. They probably got some kind of Christian Academy out there now. But
I always wonder about the, when the outlets opened in Eddyville.
Yeah, right.
I always kind of wondered about that, like how they chose Eddyville and why it was chosen. And it always seemed odd to me that they didn't purposely open it closer to Paducah or Clarksville.
Yeah.
Clarksville would have made the most sense to me because then you could attract people from Nashville.
Yeah,
more easily there, but I've always wondered about that, and those were great outlets when they were there.
They were great outlets. I think in that case, I mean, like I know anything about business, but it seems like they fell into a window that was like a no man's land where.
All outlets did. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. So. I think the reason they located where they, if I had to guess, the reason they located where they did was that it's almost like they picked that little cubby hole to where you could connect off the Western Kentucky Parkway or I-24.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
I think that's why they picked there. But I think the problem is they missed the peak of like people going out to LBL and that sort of being, you know, it used to be that. My wife always talks about that, like when she was growing up, the sort of American dream life when she was growing up is that you had a trailer or a boat down on Kentucky Lake, and that's what you did on the weekends. Whereas now, people go to stuff like, I mean, everybody goes to, or a lot of people go down to Gulf Shores. You know, their horizons have changed.
Sure.
And so that Kentucky Lake as sort of this destination place for families has changed. So I think the outlets missed that. And then the outlets did not. I-69 is still just coming about. And so Western Kentucky Parkway is only now sort of like being, you know, it's only now kind of becoming I-69. And you would have the level of traffic. That traffic is really picking up on that route now.
Is it?
Yes.
I wondered about that. If
Oh, it's totally. You totally feel it. You totally feel the difference now.
That's interesting.
It is. And now, it's nothing. If you come from a city, if you're coming from any urban area, people would laugh at that. But I'm telling you, the difference in getting up there since they turned it into I-69 in terms of, it used to be, my gosh, you could almost read a book driving down the Western Kentucky Parkway because, you know, you want to talk about wide fairways. I mean, you could veer.
No, there was nobody.
Well, you can't. I mean, it's now you have to pay attention the entire time. Huh. And it's still not, I mean, it's not I-66 or anything like that. It's nowhere near that. And so if you come from one of those cities, it still feels like a very rural, barely used roadway, but it's a discernible difference if you live here and feel it. Yeah.
Well, they also, I mean, some of that too wasn't their fault. I mean, the when it first opened, it was really at the peak of the growth of outlet malls.
Yeah.
But outlet stores were actually really good too, because like you could go to the Polo outlet store. And it wasn't a bunch of stuff specifically made to sell in the Polo outlet store.
Yes.
It was literally, you know, the stuff that was rejected from going to the stores.
Right.
I remembered buying a whole bunch of these Polo t-shirts. They were like $2 a pop or a dollar a piece or something like that because they were slightly stained. You know, the dye wasn't done properly. They were best t-shirts I've ever owned in my life. They were great. Yeah. T-shirts, right. But, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's – they fell prey to that, too, the whole – I mean, outlet stores kind of destroyed themselves.
Yeah.
To some degree, except for – like you were talking about areas like beach areas and places like that where they still exist. But, yeah, once they – I don't know. That's a whole other conversation, the demise of outlets.
I would like to have that conversation, though, because I've got a – that – I had a very sad experience at an outlet toy store recently, and that'll come up some other day. But some of the
now I'm really curious about this.
Yeah, yeah. I felt so bad for this guy who was trying to run a toy store in this place, and I was in there with my daughter, and to watch her around the toys that were in there, and see this guy's poor failing business. Oh.
Yeah, I know.
And I understood her. And she was really trying to be nice. I mean, I was so proud of her. She was doing everything she could to be gracious and that sort of thing. But he had a problem. He's not going to get around. You know?
I have to say, of all the things that never seemed to work at the outlet stores to me or outlet toy stores, they just
– yeah.
There's something really off about them.
Yeah.
But –
yeah. Well, if stuff is, I mean, toys, I mean, come on. Toys are totally about, you know, what's hot right now.
Yeah, it's in the moment. Yeah.
It's in the moment. So, yeah. Well, anyway.
Plus, you're competing with Big Lots for that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Dollar General and all those people. Yeah, I think anytime you go into a business that's on its way out, it's I find it hard. Maybe it's partly because my dad ran a business. It's hard to watch other people.
Oh, that's how it was. I mean,
sort of, you know.
Yes.
And you're never surprised when you drive by later and see the, you know, the signs up.
Oh, but it's just a killer. Places.
Yeah.
It's just a killer. It's so sad. I mean – that's what this guy, I basically told the story now, but this guy, I mean, I totally related to when mom and dad were first trying to get their pottery business going. And we'd go to some shows, and before dad really kind of found his niche of the type of pottery that would sell for a little while, I mean, there were shows where the entire weekend, like we would sell like two pieces, or I think some, they just like totally no sales. And you talk about.
Yeah, that's rough.
Oh, it was rough. I mean, that's a long weekend, and it's hard to keep a smile plastered on your face for, you know, that was.
Maybe this is why your mom developed that thing about have a nice day.
Yeah, that's probably true. That, you know what? You're totally right. I'll bet you're exactly right. That's good. Yeah, mom hates it when somebody tells her have a nice day. She doesn't trust them. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing worse than being part of a business that's failing. I mean, it's a hard.
Oh, it's corrosive.
Yeah, it's a hard feel. I mean, and you want to bail out so bad. Yeah, everybody does. It's just such a bad. Yeah. I worked at a restaurant that was kind of in that situation in Philadelphia. And
the Greek place?
Yeah, the Middle Eastern place. Yeah, it was.
Oh, Middle Eastern. Yeah.
You know, the business wasn't there. I mean, you know, it seemed like a good fit. The neighborhood needed restaurants.
Right.
But most people, you know, would choose to just go into the city.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's what, you know, Seinfeld got that right with the, remember the episodes of Seinfeld about the Pakistani restaurant?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he got that sort of like level of desperation. That show got that level of desperation, that small business owner of like, you know, he's so perplexed that it's not working that he'll take advice from anyone. You know, he's just totally going with the wind. And here's this guy who doesn't have any, he's just nice to him, but he has no experience, no insight, and he totally buys in. And yeah.
God. You're a bad man.
Yeah, bad man. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. No, I can remember. I can remember weekends, you know, being with dad at the, you know, at the cleaners on Saturdays, and Yeah, he could sit up there pretty much all day. I remember him taking naps.
Yeah. Know, yeah. Right.
Because it was so slow. But yeah. Right.
Well, yeah. And then if it's then, you know, the other side is then you get business and it's so busy, but you're scared to hire because you don't know how long it's going to last. And it's just, it's deadening to go that direction. Then when you're like so overwhelmed with how are we actually going to get all this done? And, you know,
I think the one that always gets me is when you'll see a business that pops up and it's doing great. It's like going gangbusters. They're really doing well. They're, you know, they have a solid clientele. They've been around for a couple of years now. They're doing great. Maybe they're on the in like Lone Oak, and yeah. They decide, you know what? If we just build another one of these close to the mall, right in Paducah, yeah. It's going to double our income. We're going to do great. Yeah. They end up going way in over their head to build this new store, and before you know it, both stores are gone.
Yeah,
and this great little business is completely gone, and that's always sad to watch too.
Yeah,
and that happened in Philadelphia to a business that had been around forever.
Oh yeah,
and the Italian Market area. It was kind of a landmark in Philly, and the kids took over the business, and they decided they wanted to build a store in the mall out of King of Prussia. And, you know, within a year and a half, both places were out of business. I mean, are you still there?
Still here.
Oh, you disappeared. Can you hear me? Yeah.
Oh, that's a, yeah, there's all kind of, I mean, they're so perilous, you know, they're so perilous. There's a restaurant that had been in Evansville. This, I'm not even going to mention their name, just in case I don't want to libel them. But there was a business in Evansville that, like the gambling boat moved into town, and the story is, I'm sure this is trumped up to some extent, but the story is that the guy, like his family went down to the gambling boat and they had no idea, but it turned out he was a gambling addiction. And I mean, he lost that restaurant like in no time, you know, after that. Yeah. So, I mean, they're just so perilous that no kidding that the kids who live with those people that run those things, they never, I mean, it's so rare unless it's something like, I would just say there's a lot of, I think the story of a lot of small businesses is just that, is that no one in the family has the passion or interest at all to take it over. And the economics of actually selling it are basically, you know, it's just not worth the trouble. And it is better off just selling it out for parts and, you know, whatever.
I'll leave you with a story that I thought was really sad. They did a piece on This American Life a couple of years ago now. It was around the time Marcus was born, all about Atlantic City and sort of the rise and fall of Atlantic City. I think this guy had just written a book about it.
Uh-huh.
And or made a documentary about it or something. I don't remember. But the This American Life piece was great. And he was talking about when they reopened all – you know, they opened up all these new casinos in the 80s or 70s, whenever that was.
Okay.
There was all this anticipation for all the business it was going to bring. So, you know, the opening weekend, you know, all the casinos are going to open. All the little restaurants near the casinos are, you know, they're like – he was talking about this one particular Italian place where they made all this extra food in preparation for all the people and all this stuff. Well, the way they had designed the casinos, if you're driving in from New York – you take these big exits off of the interstate, and the exits ramps take you right into the casinos parking.
Uh-oh.
And you get out and you go into the casinos, and you could literally go to the casinos and never go on the boardwalk.
Right.
You never have to leave the casino.
Right.
And so, you know, You have all these small businesses so excited and anticipating all these people. And they did get all these people, but none of them went to the businesses.
Yeah.
So, you know, literally overnight, these, you know, it's just dead, right? I mean, you've been anticipating this. This is going to be your savior. And then,
best. Yeah.
You know, in one weekend, you know, this is, it's done. You know, we're just done.
Right.
But. Oh, that was the imagery of that was really great. Talking about them throwing out all these pans of, you know, lasagna and stuff that they had made. But
yeah,
so
really.
We went long today. So, but we missed last week. So you know,
yeah, that's right. So this is kind of like a double album.
There you go. I gotta finish up my Kate Bush stuff. That reminds me.
Yeah, I like that. I like that Kate Bush stuff.
Yeah, I got to get back to that. All right. Well, I'll talk to you soon.
All right, boy.
Are we going to try to record live next week?
Is that still on?
Live. We're always live, but you know what I mean. Record together.
I would be great with that. So at some point, let us know your plans, like when you think you might be here and when you know,
sure.
What the...
Yeah.
We're wide open, so...
Okay.
Okay. I'll talk to you later.
Talk to you later. Bye.